Kære lytter, hvis der er noget, der kan holde danske erhvervsledere vågne om natten, så er det frygten for at blive udkonkurreret af tech-virksomheder. Altså, at en tech-virksomhed på en eller anden måde pludselig opstår og trænger ind udefra i ens branche og begynder at tage nogle af kunderne. Den slags sker i en moderne verden. Nogle gange så kan man godt undre sig over det, der sker. Jeg mener, hvorfor er det, at det får lov til at ske? I udlandet har vi set voldsomme eksempler på det, som da Netflix udfordrede Blockbuster, eller da Uber udfordrede taxabranchen, eller da Airbnb udfordrede hotelbranchen. Vi har også set tendensen her i landet. Tag for eksempel madspilsappen Too Good To Go. Hvorfor var det ikke dagligvarehandlen Coop eller Salling Group, der startede Too Good To Go? Eller tag bogplatformen Mofibo. Hvorfor var det ikke forlagsbranchen, der startede Mofibo? Eller tag den juridiske bistandstjeneste Airhelp. Hvorfor var det ikke advokatbranchen, der startede Airhelp? I havde talentet, I havde kunderne, I havde ressourcerne, så hvorfor gav I plads til, at nogle små tech-iværksættere udefra kunne udfordre jer og bygge en forretning, som I kunne have bygget selv? Det, synes jeg, er et interessant spørgsmål. Og især så er det et interessant spørgsmål i den her tid, fordi nu er der måske en chance for, at de traditionelle virksomheder kan slå igen mod tech-virksomhederne. Fordi tech-virksomhederne har sænket deres parader nu. De store amerikanske tech-virksomheder, de fyrer medarbejdere i tusindvis i de her måneder. Mange tech-virksomheder, også her i landet, de er presset af en ny finansiel virkelighed, fordi de stigende renter betyder, at mange år med rigelighed af penge, de er blevet afløst af en tid, hvor investorerne stiller hårdere og mere kortsigtede krav til tech-virksomhederne. Læg dertil, at de store tech-virksomheder nu begyndt at konkurrere mod hinanden, for eksempel når Microsoft og Google støder sammen inden for kunstig intelligens, og så er tech-virksomhedernes medarbejdere i øvrigt begyndt at organisere sig. Så tech-virksomhederne er blevet mere sårbare. Tech er under det største pres, som de har været under siden finanskrisen, måske endda siden dot-com-boblen for mere end 20 år siden. Jeg skrev en leder om det her emne i Børsen for 2 måneder siden. Jeg skrev, at nu er tiden kommet, hvor de traditionelle virksomheder har fået en chance for at tage revanche. Også her i landet. Det er tid til at slå igen. Jeg fik mange reaktioner på den leder, og så skete der det, at Claus Mosbæk, der er stifter og leder af Dawn Live-netværket, Dawn Live, som holder til her hos os på Børsen i Møntergade i København, at han fik besøg. Dawn Live fik besøg af forfatteren Linda Yates, og da Claus Mosbæk spurgte, om jeg havde lyst til at møde Linda Yates, så sagde jeg straks ja. For det er præcis det emne, som jeg taler om her, som hun har forstand på. Hun er vokset op i Silicon Valley. Hun har forsket og arbejdet med tech startups det meste af sit liv. Hun ved, hvordan de tænker. Og nu har hun samlet sine erfaringer i en bog, som er henvendt til de traditionelle virksomheder, dem der gerne vil vide, hvordan de tænker i Silicon Valley. En guide, simpelthen, til hvordan traditionelle virksomheder kan forsøge at skabe deres egne interne startups. Linda Yates kalder sin bog for The Unicorn Within, og den er udgivet hos Harvard Business Review. Og Linda Yates taler i interviewet her om det, som hun kalder The Mothership Advantage, som er, at traditionelle virksomheder undervurderer de mange konkurrencefordele, som de har i forhold til tech-startups. De har idéer, talent, kapital, brand, kompetencer, kanaler og kunder. Hun taler om, at traditionelle virksomheder typisk begår 3 fejl, når de skal lave en intern startup. De har ikke en metode, de har intern friktion, og deres ledere er ikke vant til at tænke i vækst på den måde, på startup-måden. Hun taler om et framework, som vi ikke når helt igennem i samtalen, men som har 4 trin, når man skal skabe en vækstmaskine. Hun kalder de 4 trin for organic venture building, venture investing, strategic partnering og targeted M&A. Hun taler om at sammensætte teams og om at forstå sine kunder, om at forstå det, som hun kalder customer pain. Og så taler hun om, at når en startup skal udvikle sig, så er der tre faser, som hun kalder build to validate, build to automate, build to scale. Og, siger hun, mange store virksomheder, de springer de to første faser over og går for hurtigt frem, fordi de er gode til den tredje fase, den med at skale. Så, kære lytter, hvis du vil have inspiration til at skabe en intern unicorn i din virksomhed, en intern startup, hvis du vil slå tilbage mod tech-iværksætterne simpelthen, hvis du vil tage kampen op mod Silicon Valley, så er her min samtale med Linda Yates. Velkommen til Topchefernes Strategi. Linda Yates, welcome to Copenhagen.
Thank you so much. It's exciting to be here.
And welcome to our podcast. And congratulations on your new book. Linda, just to be clear, how do you define a unicorn?
Great question. So unicorn is a phrase that we use pretty frequently in Silicon Valley and in the other global centers of innovation and growth. And technically the term is, it's any private company, any startup that has exceeded $1 billion in valuation prior to going public. So similarly, inside of a large company, we are looking for companies. Not every company that you, not every venture that you launch is going to become a unicorn, nor does it need to be, because there's a lot of successful companies that are kind of hitting singles, doubles, triples in American baseball speak. But unicorns typically are those that will move the needle financially, especially for multi-billion dollar multinational public companies.
And the reason why this theme is so important is that traditional companies are going out of business faster than ever before.
Absolutely. Yeah. Forbes did a really, really interesting study. And if you look at the Fortune 500 list, the average life of a company on the Fortune 500 list 50 years ago was 75 years. Today, it's 15 years and declining. But the scarier statistic is that of the companies that were on that list 50 years ago, 88% of them are out of business, off the list, or completely irrelevant.
And a reason more, maybe, the last year we have seen higher interest rates, which means that capital is not free anymore. This means that many startups are having difficulties to get funded. Have this new environment made life easier for large companies when it comes to competing with Silicon Valley?
I think it hasn't necessarily made it easier or harder, but it has created some interesting new dimensions. So remember, the venture capitalists are still sitting on billions of dollars of capital that they are investing in both the dreamers and the disruptors, the ones that are going after the large existing industries and companies. But what it has done is it has made a lot of talent available, as some of the large startups or the technology companies have laid people off. Tremendous amount of talent available to large companies that they can bring in to help accelerate and launch their own internal venture building activities. And in addition, it's also made, we talk about kind of venture building, organic venture building, investing, strategic partnering, and targeted M&A. And that targeted M&A has become far more valuable because you're not overpaying for startups with inflated valuations. So a lot more opportunities to kind of augment your internal venture building with external startups without spending too much money.
So suddenly the incumbents have a chance to hit back.
Absolutely. That's what we believe.
So by the way, why are unicorns traditionally VC-funded startups? Why haven't big companies been able to launch them successfully?
Well, I think historically for venture capitalists, it's actually been a lot easier. Now, remember, if you look at the origins of the Silicon Valley, which is where the venture capital industry was founded, all of those people were prior entrepreneurs and executives who basically decided to take the returns that they had generated and plow them back into doing more startups. So they actually not only had entrepreneurial potential, but they had entrepreneurial experience. And so they knew how to get ventures from zero to one, which is really the hardest point. If you think about a venture, ideate, incubate, accelerate, the hardest part for a large company is not the sourcing of the ideas or actually even incubating the venture, but it's getting that launched and getting it from zero to one. And there's a lot of experience among the venture capital community in doing that, which large companies historically have lacked. But that's why we wrote the book, to basically make that make that repeatable and accessible and teachable as a method.
We see the same pattern in Denmark, that that founders, they are reinvesting their money in new startups. So your mission is basically to tell large companies or incumbent companies, you can do this, you can make a startup within if you are able to seize what you call a mothership advantage.
Yes.
So let's start and look at the large companies, their strengths and challenges. Let's take the strengths first. We are used to, at least I'm used to see large companies as disadvantaged compared to startups. But actually, when you compare them, large companies have several competitive advantages.
They have amazing competitive advantages. If you think about it, every large company has ideas, talent, capital, brand, competencies. They have channels. They have customers. I mean, imagine, there's no reason that any of the large hotel companies could not have created Airbnb. There's absolutely no reason that any of the large car companies couldn't have launched Uber, or the big financial services companies or banks couldn't have launched Stripe, which currently has a $65 billion valuation, even in a downturn. So large companies absolutely do have all of these advantages. Where what they also have are inertia, antibodies, and orthodoxies that sometimes will starve these new ventures of oxygen or kill them. But the no startup, I had a meeting with a new CEO of a European car company, and he said, Linda, you know, how much money do I have to put in a venture fund to be successful? And I literally looked across the table and I said, zero. It's no money, because Silicon Valley doesn't need your money. I said, how many customers do you have? He said, 30 million. I said, okay, let's start there. No startup starts with the advantage of 30 million customers.
All of these assets, are they what you call the mothership advantage?
Yes, absolutely. We used to talk about managing the mothership, and then I realized that is just too negative a term. It really is about seizing the mothership advantage.
Do the large companies underestimate these assets, their mothership advantage?
Most of them actually, yes. We usually, when we work with a company, what I would say to your listeners is start with what we call an asset jam. What are the core competencies, assets, capabilities? What can you either bring to a venture you're investing in or a venture you're building? But more importantly, many of them actually know that they've got these capabilities, but they haven't done the next step, which is how do you build the infrastructure? How do you build the internal innovation and growth ecosystem among your organization, across your functions and departments, to unleash those competitive advantages for the benefit of your growth-oriented ventures?
Maybe this will also demand a completely new way of thinking in large companies.
Yes. I think actually, though, that's overestimated. Many large companies actually have plenty of internal entrepreneurs. Remember, they were all startups at one time, and many of the people who are in there. Now, not everyone is meant to be an entrepreneur. A lot of people inside of a large organization may not like the pace or the lack of structure or having to talk to customers even, but there are plenty of internal entrepreneurs. And even those who don't want to be an entrepreneur, they are absolutely entrepreneurial. They want growth. They want change. They want to basically be part of something new and different. So I think a lot of people really don't take advantage of it. They don't have the systems and processes to take advantage of it. They know it's there. They just haven't done it yet.
Okay, we'll get back to that. And the large companies, they also have challenges when it comes to try to think like a startup. For once, they don't have a methodology when they try to basically copy startups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's three things that typically we find get in the way of success, building a successful growth engine through venture building and venture investing. And those are, first of all, no methodology. Even those that do try to start a venture factory, they think, oh, I'm just going to be like Y Combinator or Techstars or 500 Startups or one of the classic incubators in whatever region you happen to be in. The problem with that is those entities are like venture capital funds. They have limited partners. And so they actually don't need a high success rate to be successful and return their fund. They can invest in 20, but only two can do well and return the fund. a large multinational, multi-billion dollar public company or even private family-owned company cannot afford that kind of failure rate. And so having a methodology means you have, you can actually bring more people into the process. It can be repeatable. It can be scalable. It also means that senior executives will feel confident and your board will feel confident that everybody has done the work that they need to do to be worthy of having their venture invested in. So that's really important.
So part of this methodology is you have to accept failure.
At 100%. And you have to learn to kill ventures. And that's one of the things that, that we talk about. So that, that part of that methodology is both the, you know, on the building, but it's also understanding, great, if there's no customer pain, you don't have a venture, therefore you need to kill it. Or if we, to solve the customer pain is time travel, well, guess what? We don't have time travel. So the product isn't feasible to build, so you need to kill it. Or if there's no way to make money. So methodology is one. The second big challenge then is you don't seize the mothership advantage. You basically have a lot of friction. You have a lot of orthodoxies, inertia, and antibodies, but basically you have a bunch of people stepping back saying, well, you know, not invented here, that's not my idea, therefore. And so really, it's very important that you do understand, run an asset gem, figure out what all your capabilities and assets and where they are, and then build the infrastructure and get and create the, what we call the growth advocates inside who want to bring their capabilities of their organization, their department, their division to help these ventures, these fledgling ventures, reach escape velocity to drive growth for the organization.
So you have to be very aware of what you call friction, because if you don't, you cannot unlock your internal.
Completely. Exactly. Exactly.
And then you have a third challenge.
Your executive decision makers fail to grow. So this isn't just about the middle management or your new people or the heads of your divisions. This is about the senior executive group and your board learning to become top-tier venture capitalists and have that mentality. So what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is you don't get to sit back. You know, we're not talking about Shark Tank. You don't get to sit back as management review board members and, you know, your whole job is to throw up over anybody's new idea. Your job is to lean in like a venture capitalist does and to think in terms of portfolio. There's no way you can drive financial impact for your organization if you just invest in or build one venture. So you've got to think in terms of a portfolio and doing that, kind of removing the greatest amount of risk on the least amount of capital. You've got to think in terms of option value, not net present value. And you've got to rethink the metrics with which you are measuring your new ventures. You can't use the core and legacy business metrics on a quarterly basis. You've got to think longer term, and you've got to use the same metrics that the financial markets use to value a startup that goes public: customer acquisition, the growth of customer acquisition, and revenue growth. And those two things are really the key metrics that every CEO, C-suite, and board member needs to learn.
But when I see Danish CEOs, there's a world of difference between a typical CEO for a large company and then thinking like a VC. It's two completely different tasks.
Yes, but you can learn it. You can adopt it. You can literally, it's not that difficult. And a lot of times, it's not even the CEO's fault, frankly. It's the financial markets who drive these poor leaders to basically have to think in terms of quarterly results. Frankly, we're doing a big article for HBR on valuing the unicorn within. And we're going hard after the financial markets because they're the ones who basically, on the one hand, are saying, oh, quarterly results. And on the other hand, letting some Silicon Valley VC's startup go public with a 20x multiple and no profit. Guess what? The internal ventures are just as valuable as those external ventures.
But I guess the leadership responsibility remains at the CEO, not at the financial markets.
Yes, except that the financial markets, if they don't value their unicorns in the way that these CEOs of unicorns in the way that they should, then it's hard for them to break out. So when a company goes out of business, the financial markets bear responsibility. You know, if a GE or a Kodak, that's hundreds of thousands of jobs that are lost. So yes, but in the end, what we say is it's very difficult for someone at a middle management level to be the one who's driving and building a growth engine. It has to come from the CEO. Pricewaterhouse did a statistic of a survey that they ran prior to Davos, that they released at Davos. 40% of the CEOs around the world believe that their organizations will no longer be economically viable in 10 years if they don't transform. My answer to that is stop whining. That is your job. And there are opportunities to build a growth engine through venture building, through venture investing, through execution, not strategy. You don't need more PowerPoint slides. You need to actually run experiments, place bets, run pilots, and get moving.
So, three common mistakes for large companies: no methodology, mothership, friction, and executive decision makers fail to grow. Now, let's talk about the solution, your solution to all this. In your book, you present a framework, and to achieve all this, a company needs to build its own growth engine, and you have four steps. You call them organic venture building, venture investing, strategic partnering, and targeted M&A. We don't have time today to go through all four, so I would like to ask you some specific questions about this process across the spectrum from ideate to incubate to accelerate to scale. First, you need to assemble a team to come up with ideas, and that means that the company needs to free up employees.
Yes, absolutely. So there's typically, when people start, they have some, there's one of two ways that companies start. They either have a team, or they have a business division or a unit that has an idea that they want to basically, they believe they could turn into a new line of business or a new venture, and then they will assemble the team. Sometimes, and they have a team that's working on it, sometimes they understand a pain that the customers have, and then they assemble the team based on the pain. So sometimes you start with a team who has an idea, sometimes you start with a pain and you assemble the team. Doesn't really matter where you're doing, because in both cases, your next step is you're going to go and look for customer pain.
So I'm just curious, Linda. So does this mean that first you assemble your team and then you start thinking on what problem you're going to solve for your customers? Or is it the other way around? Or is it some kind of both?
It's both. It's either. Let's put it that way.
So when you assemble a team, which criteria should a management use?
Ah, great. So when we believe that anybody can become an entrepreneur if they have the right kind of demeanor and want to be an entrepreneur, you can teach people the skills of being an entrepreneur. Believe me. Half the 25-year-olds in Silicon Valley didn't know how to start a company, right? They just kind of didn't know any better. They didn't know what they didn't know, so they would just start. So, but what is really important when you're assembling a team is more around, can they handle being an entrepreneur, right? Can they handle the pace, the lack of structure? Can they handle talking to hundreds? We believe that when you incubate a venture, you should be interviewing between 100 and 400 customers in 12 weeks. Okay. So really you're looking for people. There's two things that kill a venture. It's not enough pain, so not a big enough market, and what we call toxic team members. So team members who don't get along, founders who basically really start fighting with each other. So assembling a team is really important. And it's also really important often for your chief human resources officers, because many of them love venture building and venture investing, because it's a way for you as an established incumbent to attract and retain new people. So the whole team aspect is very important.
I've seen that you have said we look less for skills, more for capabilities. What does that mean?
More for characteristics. So less for have actually built a startup before, and more to the point of what I was just saying, where they can handle the pace of being an entrepreneur. They can handle what it's like to start a company in just 12 weeks. So we're just looking for people who are excited by that, as opposed to somebody who is anxious about that. Now, that doesn't mean that the person anxious about it can't be a great entrepreneur, but you have to basically scaffold them in a different way and maybe give them a different role. Maybe they're not the CEO, maybe they're the customer success person, or they're the back office administrator.
So this is not only for what you call the cool people. It's right. it's for in principle, everyone, it's people from legal, procurement, finance. Yes. Everyone can participate.
Great, great point. So when we think about venture building and venture investing, building your growth engine, there's actually four types of teams that you want to be thinking about. What we were just discussing is if you are launching a new venture and who are the types of people who are going to be your internal entrepreneurs, your founding members of that new venture team. That's a very important team. There's three other important teams. Number one is your new venture board. The new venture board are those senior executives who are going to play your internal venture capitalists and make those go, no go, fund, no fund decisions. They're in charge of the governance of the venture ultimately. They're the board. Then the third group is, in essence, those people, we like to call them the Mach 49 inside. They're the people who are running the venture factory or the growth division or the CVC, the Corporate Venture Capital Group. They're the ones who are facilitating the venture building and the venture investing. They're not staying with a venture. You know, the people who are on the venture, they'll learn the methodology, they'll do it. But if you launch that venture, they're kind of gone to you because they're off building the business for you. They can't go do the next one, the next one, the next one. And it's very important. Remember, we talked about having a portfolio mindset because you need more shots on goal to really have the opportunity to create unicorns and not have just one that you kill that you say, oh, now I'm never going to do it again. So the new venture, the CVC, Venture Factory, Growth Division people are very important. And the last group, and this is what you were just referring to, are what we call the growth advocates or the new venture advocates. Not everybody is an entrepreneur, but many people are entrepreneurial. And that you want to look for that one person in legal who's going to write the one-page term sheet for the pilot you want to run, not the 40-page term sheet. You want the person in procurement who, if you're a pet food company and you need to do you're doing a hardware product, you don't have a pre-approved hardware prototyper on your vendor list, you need someone who can do that in 2 weeks, not 2 months. You need somebody who in HR who knows what a growth hacker is or who in marketing is not going to be the brand police. It's also then, by getting those people involved, you're not creating the haves and the have-nots, the cool kids and the uncool kids. Those people who are doing ventures, that's really cool, that's what I want to do. Or those people running the venture factory or the CVC, they're the cool people. And everybody else running the core and legacy business isn't. That's just not true. Those are the people who help you unlock the mothership advantage and help the ventures reach escape velocity. So those growth advocates, those new venture advocates, letting everyone be part of the growth story is very important.
So I guess this is very important. In any large organization, you actually have internally, you have entrepreneurs. You just need to find them and motivate them to apply.
100%. Unlocking them. So this is why in some cases with clients, they'll run a venture competition. Some people know who they are. Some people, their heads of talent or their chief human resources officers really know kind of the ones that are agitating for change or a growth opportunity. Sometimes you'll run a venture competition. And when we have clients run a venture competition, we make you put two buttons on the website. One is, I have an idea, I want to submit. The other is, I don't have an idea, but I'm entrepreneurial and I want to be part of a team. And we did that, for instance, with Intel, and they had 800 people sign up on that button, right? And that's super important now because now your head of talent knows where those entrepreneurial people are. And even if we don't have enough space for them on a team, you can start doing programming for those people that make them feel like they're part of the growth story.
So assembling a great team is very important. And you also mentioned the other things you need to do. You also need to have funding. Do you need anything else to get started?
Well, let me just say one moment on the funding, because I do think it's important for people to understand, you know, when we look at kind of how you do venture building, we say, look, it's about understanding customer pain, marrying it with the art of the possible. What are the current trends and technology you can use to solve that pain, and placing a series of small bets, running pilots, experiments, removing the greatest amount of risk on the least amount of capital. When we think about funding, we need your companies that you're talking to on this podcast to be thinking like a venture capitalist. This is not 20 million euros per venture. This is 100,000 to run an experiment, right? So it's very important when you think about funding, you don't have to put billions of revenue billions of euros aside, or dollars aside, or yen aside, to basically be able to do venture building and venture investing. You need to be very mindful on how you manage the burn, if you will, the cash burn. So yes, you need funding. And the reason you need funding a priori, or to know where it's coming from, is because when you incubate a venture, you 100% will be talking to customers. And if you do a good job, then those customers are going to sign up and want to be pilots. So by the end of 12 weeks, you have customers and pilots. If you are now running around and taking 3 months to go find the seed funding you need to run the pilots that those customers have already raised their hand to be part of, then you're going to lose those customers. So that's why that funding is important. The other thing you really do need is you need to be customer obsessed. So, we help people build ventures. We also help them turn them around if they tried to do them on their own or transform them and they aren't reaching their full potential. And often what we find is we'll go in and the first thing we'll ask is, how many customers did you interview? 10. Okay, no. 12 weeks. We talk about 100 to 400 customers you are interviewing, not surveying. I tell CEOs all over the world, surveys are statistically significant and strategically irrelevant because all you've done is outsource your visceral understanding and empathy for the customer to somebody else, whether you're B2B, B2C, B2B2C. So it's really important to be customer obsessed.
So to understand customer, data is not enough. You need to be close, emotional, intuitive.
100%.
Feel them. Meet them.
Absolutely. And that's why we use the word, when we say customer insights are the currency of credibility. Everything else is uninformed opinion. And so if you're a CEO and you go to your team and say, I have this opinion about what we should be doing, your team's going to look at you and say, great, where's your customer interview? We'll be happy to put it in the database. Or if you haven't done any customer interviews, we're happy to test it. But one of the things that's also very important here is it's not about user research. It's about customer development. We use those words intentionally. Every interview your teams do with a customer and over the course of the incubate and then on into accelerate after you've launched the actual venture is an opportunity to turn that interview into a customer. And so you've got to learn listening skills. You're there not to sell them something, but to solve their pain. And that's a mindset. That's the bigger mindset shift that a lot of people have to have. So that customer development focus is really, really important in terms of what else you need besides the team and the funding.
But I guess any CEO in any large company would say that he or she, we know this, we know we have to be very close to our customers.
Yeah, but then when I do speeches I just did a speech in front of 200 Fortune 500 board members, and I asked them specifically, how many of you have interviewed a customer of the company on whose board you sit in the last year? And only 2 of the 200 hands went up. And I said, that's unacceptable. Your shareholders should vote you off the board.
And the reason why this is very important, especially when you think like a startup, I guess you call it customer pain. You really need to know what is the customer pain.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can't get that through surveys. And again, one of the problems that, and of course, in Silicon Valley, we never talk about all the roadkill, right? There's a lot of roadkill in Silicon Valley. And that's typically because we have smart engineers who think they have the answer and they don't talk to customers either. And so this is something a startup can learn. And this is something that a large company can learn as well. But it really is important for those customers to, for you to hear from those customers. And it's important for you not to be out selling. You're not asking them, hey, I've got this product. Do you want the blue one or the red one? You're literally, and we talk about three types of interviews. The first is actually an open-ended pain point interview where you're basically saying, tell me about the last time you tried to rent an office. Just talk me through that experience. Or you tried to buy a car or whatever it is, but it's an open-ended. And then from there, once you hear, you'll start to very quickly be able to answer the question yourself because you'll have heard the same thing over and over. Now you move to what we call storyboard or value proposition interviews where you're now testing solutions and ideas you have to solve that pain. And then ultimately, you're going to move into what we call prototype interviews, which is if you're doing a digital product, you're using wireframes. If you're doing hardware, you're doing mockups. Or if you're doing an experience, you're doing simulations.
So when you have assembled all this, you know also now what your customers want. You will do the final pitch for your internal venture board. And if they say go, what are the final steps to get your new product or service to the market?
Right. So, you know, you've gone now through the process where you've sourced your idea through the ideate phase. You've now incubated over 12 weeks looking at customer, looking at the product or the solution, and looking at building your business plan. And by the way, at the end of the incubate phase, you should have a very robust and rigorous business plan. This is not speed dating. This is not a 5-minute demo presentation. This is literally a very robust and rigorous business plan. And in the book, we actually have the table of contents we believe every new venture and every large organization should use. Content's different, but the topics are the same. It means you've done the work. Now, congratulations. They've said, this is very exciting. You have 12 customer pilots. Now you're going to move into the accelerate phase. You're going to launch. This is the phase that a lot of large companies fall down on because they've never started. They weren't there when the company started. So they don't know how to get a venture from zero to one. There, we talk about two different very critical things when you move into the accelerate phase. Number one is that there are actually three phases: build to validate, build to automate, build to scale. Many large companies try to skip the first and go straight to build to automate or build to scale because you're really, really good at that. But build to validate is when you're now in the market. Now you're basically looking, taking your minimum viable product, you're testing it, you're adding features, you're still doing a lot of customer development. You're still talking to tons of customers. You're still running pilots and experiments and placing small bets to remove that greatest amount of risk on the least amount of capital, as we talked about earlier. But it's not just the three phases that are important. You need to be running experiments and pilots and small bets across what we call 5 swim lanes. Yes, you're working on the product, and that's the sexy part. That's the part everybody wants to pay a lot of attention to is the actual product. But you need to also be paying attention to 4 other things. Number one, what is your go-to-market strategy? How are you accessing the customers? Are you using inside sales? Are you using field sales? Are you using digital? How are you reaching them? You need to run experiments, because if you just go build a field sales force and that isn't the way that your customers want to buy, then you just wasted a whole bunch of money. So you want to run experiments on your go-to-market. The second thing is your business model. How are you going to price? How do your customers want to buy? So you need to go be running experiments on that, because you don't want to say, oh, we're a SaaS model, but then you find out that people want to buy it they just want to buy it outright. Now, again, you've wasted too much time. So you're running experiments there. The third is on how you're going to deliver your product or your service or your solution, because you have to get to positive unit economics. You can get the first 3 things, product, go-to-market, and pricing, business model, right? But if you can't get to positive unit economics on the operations, then you're dead in the water. And then the last thing, which continues to be important, is team. So you might have had the most amazing team for the incubation, but you might have identified there are some gaps on that team. You need to be able to recruit for that team. So now you got to be thinking about things like, how are we going to compensate? What kind of experiments are we going to run there? How are we going to reward people for performance? So those are the things you need to be thinking about as you move to accelerate.
Thank you, Linda. I have a few final questions. I know that many large companies struggle with one question. When you have succeeded building a new business, do you run it independently or do you integrate it into your incumbent organization?
That is a great question. So often, we always say pre-party planning prevents poor performance. So that's a question we usually ask you all the way at the beginning. We say, what do you want to do with these ventures in the end? Do you want to spin them in to an existing business unit? Do you want to keep them as a wholly owned subsidiary? Or do you want to spin them out? And there is no wrong answer. All 3 are fine. Here is typically what we find. If you are going to spin it in, you must be aware of the timing of when you spin them back in. So because you will have a business unit, and that business unit head set their budgets a year ago. You've now incubated this hot new venture that, oh, by the way, still isn't generating a lot of revenue and has no profit. You can't hand that over to that poor guy or gal who's running that business unit because they don't have the budget to do it. So they're going to starve it of oxygen or kill it if you don't pay attention to it. So if you're going to spin it in, you've still got to keep it in the incubator, in your venture factory, in your growth division, long enough so that it can be kind of become a shiny object for their sales force, and it can be generating revenue and product market fit. So it's worth it for them to take it on. So it's for spin-in, it's a matter of timing, not whether you do it. Most of our clients, because they're multi-billion dollar multinational public companies, they want to keep them as wholly owned subsidiaries because they're using these ventures to be to make a mind shift change among the financial markets. So they're perceived as growth stocks, not value stocks. So they want to keep them inside so they get the benefit of being perceived not just for the financial returns, but as being an innovative and growth-minded company. And those are very easy. The third option is to spin them out. Most of our clients don't because they want to retain that value. When they do, it's usually for two reasons. Reason one is that it's a heavy capital infrastructure play. So they want to share the risk on the investment that needs to take place. Or number two, it's a venture that's two or three adjacencies away from their core business. They need other superpowers to make that venture successful. So they'll run it as a joint venture. They'll bring other partners in. We actually are seeing more and more consortia-based incubation or venture building. Venture investing has always been more syndicate-based, and we're seeing more kind of joint ventures where companies are incubating ventures together.
One perspective in this is that often a startup, it takes a long time, several years before they make any revenue and any income. That must be a very crucial and difficult thing to handle for a large company.
Yep. So this is why we actually are talking about two different mechanisms that make it easier for large companies to do this. And this is where startups have an unfair advantage. One is they get these multiples that they don't deserve, that your ventures should get the same type of multiple. So one is being able to communicate to the financial markets why your ventures actually are worthy because they have customer acquisition numbers to basically drive those valuations, and they have revenue, even if they might not have profit.
In present time, we are all fascinated by ChatGPT and Bard and AI and generative AI. Does this have any impact on the playing field between the large companies and small startups for creating unicorns?
I think it has profound effects. I think it doesn't necessarily mean, so the startups have an added advantage because they're not going to wait to use it. They're just going to go for it. The large companies are going to do way too much analysis paralysis, right? But the benefits that will accrue could accrue equally to a startup outside as to a startup inside. We have one venture right now who's in stealth mode for a large company. And the CEO of that venture is so excited about generative AI because he said right now they're making 10x the progress because their code is basically writing itself now because they have enough of it. I think the one challenge that we have to all be careful of, though, is that if everybody's using the same training data and using the same basic information, we run the risk of homogenizing the opportunities and that everybody comes up with the same ideas. And so I think there's going to be a balance between kind of, and this is where I think, frankly, the large companies have an advantage. Because whereas startups can't access as many customers as a large company, I think the large companies can take advantage of the generative AI much better than some of the startups because it will allow them to free up their talent to do far more value-adding growth-focused things than they might otherwise be doing because they can take advantage of the AI. They can also leverage the data that they have from 30 million customers versus a startup who only might have 5 or 10 customers to actually move faster and iterate and pivot faster so they can find product market fit and generate revenue faster.
So generative AI can be a competitive advantage for the mothership.
Absolutely.
Linda, I need to ask you, of course, do I have an example of a large company building a unicorn?
Yeah. I just talked to you about RWE starting Pear.ai. Schneider Electric created a really brilliant kind of home solar as a service company called Clipsol Solar. You can go online. You can see all of these. We have, there's a number of them. Intel, I just shared I just did a talk to an executive education class here in Copenhagen, and I just shared this amazing, you can go online and look at it. It's a company called Omnibridge about bringing the deaf and the hearing worlds together. Very, very inspirational CEO coming out of Intel. really incredible, leveraging Intel's real-time processing, their computer vision, their AI capabilities, but really amazing. So we've got lots of examples and happy to share them at any point in time.
My very last question. To the CEOs of large companies who have heard this podcast, what is your key takeaway from your work and from your book?
You've got to focus on execution and not keep doing PowerPoint slides on strategy. So for us, it literally is about just do it. It is about, you know, just start with one. Either now, a lot of companies, you know, we talk about venture building, venture investing. It doesn't matter where you start. Sometimes people want to dip their toe in the water and just get themselves up to speed on what the art of the possible is, what the current technology and trends are out in the world. So they're going to do venture investing or partnering or starting an external accelerator. They've got really talented people inside. They want to give them that opportunity. Just start with one venture. Just place a series of small bets and get going. Start talking to your customers, understand that customer pain. But it really is stop focusing on the quarterly results, because you're going to quarterly result yourself out of business as opposed to growth. And we are very, very focused on building growth engines, not just innovation, because innovation you can't measure. We're all about how do you measure, how are you going to measure? You can measure growth. And so that's a really important dimension for CEOs, because you've got to have something to take back to your board. But don't expect this to happen in the bowels of your organization. If you are the senior executive, you are the CEO, you are the board member, it is your responsibility to drive growth for your organizations and to unleash the unicorns within.
Linda Yates, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Det var denne udgave af Topchefernes Strategi. Et forsøg på at blive klogere på, hvordan traditionelle virksomheder kan forsøge at tænke som en startup. I virkeligheden så synes jeg, at den vigtigste iagttagelse, som Linda Yates kommer med, hvis jeg skal give et bud på den iagttagelse, som gjorde det største indtryk på mig, så er det den med, at de traditionelle virksomheder har nogle konkurrencefordele, som i virkeligheden er meget stærke i forhold til tech-startups. Altså når Linda Yates taler om det, som hun kalder for the mothership advantage, som er, at traditionelle virksomheder, de har idéer, de har talent, de har kapital, de har brand, de har kompetencer, de har kanaler, de har kunder. Det lyder måske banalt, men når man tænker over det, så er det jo rigtigt. Traditionelle virksomheder, både de små og de store, har nogle virkelig værdifulde aktiver, som små tech-startups nærmest per definition ikke har endnu. Den erkendelse, synes jeg, er et godt sted at starte, især mentalt for en virksomhed, der vil forsøge at tænke nyt og vil forsøge at slå tech-startup-virksomheder, før at de angriber dig udefra. Tak til Claus Mosbæk, stifter og direktør hos Dawn Live. Tak til Jesper Nytoft Bergmann, der er direktør hos AVT Business School, hvor jeg fik lov til at lave optagelsen med Linda Yates. Og tak til Linda Yates, der har skrevet bogen The Unicorn Within. Tak til Arjuna Alexander Koldkur Sørensen, der redigerede optagelsen. Og tak til dig, der lyttede med.